When you write a melody for a very complex song, like a song, we wrote a song about divorce, when Abby's mom and dad, she was talking about them being divorced and having big feelings about it. The song was called Big Feelings. Your melody has to be a child's melody. So they have to be able to sing it because if they're thinking about it, it's like when a child dreams or plays, how they're playing they're playing simply, but they're playing because they're having such big feelings. So the melody has to be a kid's melody, but the things behind it project the feelings that you really want, you know, the feelings, the real things. And so when you have a complex song, it's important to like empathize with the child, what they're actually feeling, those feelings they don't have words for, and they don't even maybe know they're having, like sometimes.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. There's such a fascinating variety to a life in music. This series features wonderful musicians worldwide with in-depth conversations and great music. Today's guest is the Emmy-winning songwriter, singer, and producer Kat Rayo Rendy. Together with her husband, JP Rendy, she has a successful songwriting and production company, Earworm Music Company. This episode is a fascinating window into the world of music for children's TV shows, jingles, working with celebrities, and music production in general. Kat's infectious delight in music, composition, and singing, as well as her personal story and perspectives as a parent, will fascinate listeners everywhere. Like all my episodes, you can listen to this on your favorite podcast player, watch the video on YouTube, read the transcript, and navigate with the timestamps. Please sign up for my weekly newsletter at leahroseman.com and consider supporting this independent podcast with a few dollars. The links are in the description of the episode.
Hi, Kat. Thanks so much
for
joining me here today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So there's so much to talk about with Earworm Company and your background, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about JP. But I thought it'd be fun to start with a couple of your beautiful Sesame Street projects that I found so inspiring. So you wrote this song that was awarded an Emmy for Billy Porter. So can you talk about that project?
Yeah, Billy Porter's been a big influence of mine for a long time. So when we got the call for the song, I was so excited. I'm like, I'm on this right now. I have been a fan of his since probably Love's on the Way, which he sang for the First Wives Club as a demo for Celine Dion's Love is on the Way. And then it became his version, became so big, and he hit all the notes that Celine hit. Like, I had heard her version first. And then my songwriter friend Peter Zizzo showed it to me. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. And he was like, yeah, she sang his riffs when she did the cover of it. She sang wow. everything he did. And all those high notes, with the exception of the key change, everything else was like his notes. So I became a super fan of his. And when we got the call to do a song for him, I was like so excited. And I jumped right in and I'm like, I know what we're going to do. And Sesame Street has a really good research department where we don't write the lyrics most of the time because it goes through such educational research department. The research department makes sure that every lyric in there is accurate, whether it's a scientific or psychological or developmental, everything is screened. So most of the time there's a lyricist. So Ken Scarborough just did the lyrics for the song. And we were like, we have to make this a Billy Porter song, a song that he can sink his teeth into. And so, you know, when as a songwriter, you just close your eyes and you try to become them as a writer. Respectfully, of course. And so we took, you know, his latest album, and just went for it. And when he sang it and he put his all into it, and it came back, I'm like, oh my God, this is just amazing. We wrote his style chords and his style instrumentation. And it was this beautiful song about inclusion. And he wore his Met Gala gown for the video, and it just stood there in all his Billy Porter glory with this amazing piece of fashion on. And like, it really was something special, I thought.
Mm-hmm. And this was like a new thing for the Emmys to have a kids sort of section or special awards.
Yeah, it was the first time. It was the Kids and Family Emmys.
Mm-hmm. And they seem to really focus on diversity in their in that.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And there has been such a gigantic like influx of kids programming in general because of streaming, but kids programming where you could focus on a very specific like type of character or concept or whatever. Whereas in the past, growing up, I had Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers, and that was kind of it. I mean, there was a few other things, of course. But because of this just amazing amount of programming, they had their own Emmys. And so there was so much really great, like, there were some really good shows that were nominated. Sneakerella, that was a really great show, where it was a little bit Cinderella-y, but it was based on actual, I believe the person was making sneakers. Mm-hmm. But the songs are amazing. And so there were so many different shows of very specific concepts that were included in the Emmys this year. It was so cool. Mm-hmm.
Here's a short audio clip of Billy Porter singing Friends with a Penguin. The original Sesame Street video is linked in the show notes. This song won the Emmy Award for Outstanding Original Song in the 2022 Children's and Family Emmy Awards, composed by Kat Rayo-Rendy and J.P. Rendy.
I saw somebody I didn't know, I felt shy. Afraid to say hi, I wasn't sure she'd like me, then I tried. Hi.
Hi.
Wanna play tag?
Sure, you're it.
Now I'm friends with a penguin. It starts by saying hi. Invite someone to play with you. You'll have a friend.
And they'll have one too.
So give it a try.
In a lot of ways, we both like T-ball and the sky.
We like taking turns and sharing things.
And both of us can't fly.
We can't fly.
Penguins can't fly.
We both like pizza topped with anchovies. We both want puppies.
Free, free.
We both like dancing. And guess what? Both of us have knees. We have knees.
Well, congratulations on that award.
Thanks.
And there's this beautiful video you created a song for, let's see, We Don't Walk Alone.
I love that. Was that, I think that might be my favorite Sesame song we did. I'm not sure. It was a song about violence, and the kid's by himself, and he's one by one, after he's talking about how he's feeling alone and sad, one by one, visually, each character comes into the frame. And then all of a sudden, like, the whole community stands with them, with him. And we wanted to make the song sonically like that as well. So it starts out just him. And then all of a sudden, the music gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the harmonies get more gigantic. And all of a sudden, it's this full production, whereas it's a very small, almost folk-like song at the beginning. And it was so nice to do that, because like most of the time, JP and I, when we work for Sesame Street, are writing as pop writers, but this time we got to do more of like a theatrical version of our pop songs. And like within that genre, you can really go back and forth. And the song starts in the beginning as this like unsure, there's almost an uncertain key of the song, uncertain mode, an uncertain, you know, whole tone, like back and forth, like I don't know how I feel. And then as it gets bigger and bigger, it becomes more centered in its key, but also like a little bit more complex in the instrumentation and in the lush harmonies and stuff. And it became this like you are assured by your family and your community that you literally are not alone. You are supported, and that's how we get by. And so that Sesame's recently has been like a big thing. Like we did another one about fathers specifically taking care of their kids emotionally, which a lot of times, even though it happens, people don't focus on it. Shows don't focus on it. And I think that many shows recently have shown the fathers emotionally taking care of their kids. And the big takeaway from that is that having people, having community is really important growing up.
Mm-hmm. Here's a short audio clip of Sesame Street's We Don't Walk Alone, composed by Kat Rayo Rendy and JP Rendy. The Sesame Street video is linked in the show notes.
Sometimes I feel like I'm all alone, just walking by myself, just out here on my own.
But here I am, and I'll take your hand. I'll walk right by your side and help you understand that you are not alone. I'll walk next to you.
I thought I was just one,
but now we both are two. And we're not alone. You walk here with me.
If Elmo walks along with you, together we are three.
And we're not alone. We walk hand in hand. We are stronger all together. And now we understand
that we're not alone. There are so many more.
If we all walk together, then our group turns into four.
Yeah, that video, We Don't Walk Alone. I've showed it to quite a few friends and family, and every time I tear up. Like, it's so beautiful. And I'll link both of these. Anything that we don't include, I'll try to include in the show notes so people can check them out.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
Now, you said we could include some music from Baby Shark.
Yeah. We can include... there's a few songs that I like. I really like they're all silly songs. They're all fun and silly, and I call them neurospicy because I'm a little neurospicy, but they always describe the songs in the briefs as left of center because they're all like when you listen to a My Little Pony, and that's fun and exciting in its own way. When they use the term every pony, it's funny because, you know, it's sweet and funny and it related to its show. But when you say every fishy or like everything that relates to fish is just generally so gross, like that it creates every time you talk about the fish world, it's funny. Like we have a lot of like, let me think of what it is. What's that smell? It smells like kelperoni. Every time you talk about, you know, stinky fish or fish in general, it's funny. And so the show leans into it. And of course, the Baby Shark brand is, everyone knows Baby Shark. So we wanted to kind of make the music a little bit... obviously keep it catchy, but also have its own personality. And I think doing the funny, crazy version of music with this show was the right way to go. So we did a few songs that were really fun. One was with Cardi B called Seaweed Sway, where Cardi B, like, Baby Shark can do things that other shows can't do because it's gigantic, number one. And number two, because it's allowed to be its own thing because it's just a funny show in general. Like, you can have Cardi B on it, and when she came on, she like really did it. She like really cared about what she was doing. She did it right, like, in my opinion. She like really cared. And I know, like, of course celebrities care, but you just expect them to like, oh, it's a kid's show, you know, let's do it and move on. But that she like got into the studio, and she, when she was on that mic, she was on, and she cared, and she recorded her daughter, and her husband was on it. Like, it was cool. It was really cool. So she did that song, A Seaweed's Way, and she's teaching everybody how to, like, dance like her and be like her and say, like, you are who you are and don't apologize for it. Just be you and do it your own way. So that was a really fun song, Seaweed's Way. And then we did some other really fun ones. There was a song at the end of season one called Flow On. And it was this wild, like, almost Phantom of the Opera style production that the theatrical character Goldie was putting on. And it turned out that the character, Hank, who was supposed to play the lead, was so nervous about playing the lead that he sabotaged the whole thing. And in the end, when it was time for the song, he was like, the first character who became the lead said, this is my chance to have my moment in the sun. This is my chance to be, this is my chance. Concessions are for Hank. And then Hank, who is at the concession stand, is giving his concession, his apology, saying, this is my chance to really say sorry. This is my chance to sell delicious snacks. And it goes on to be this big, it's almost similar to we Don't Walk Alone, in the sense that it becomes bigger and bigger, but it becomes like celebratory and fun, and all the characters who have all their motives. They each have this like motive, this lesson that they learned in the show. Like, the show will flow on. Go flow on, meaning go on and say what you want to say instead of like holding your feelings in. And in that way, the show has, so they call it socio-emotional. They have lessons in the show, but they do it so fun, which I really like.
And are you singing on any of those tracks in Baby Shark?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I sing all the backup vocals for our songs in the show. And so there's a song where William, the baby's best friend William, who's a pilot fish, he decides that he's going to be, you know, a big fishy now, and he wants to become an adult. So he asks all the characters in the show you know, to help him to do what it would take for him to be mature. And so finally he reveals himself as Billiam. He's like, I'm not William anymore. And from now on, call me Billiam. And we have this like big rap song. And I sing the chorus. I sing like the choir. They're like, Billiam! Oh, I'm so grown. I sing that. I sing backups on kind of everything in the show. I mean, all my songs, at least. Our songs.
Yeah. So when you're writing with JP, so, you know, you guys have a company together, but you're also married and have children. Do you help each other, like, with writer's blocks? Do you always apportion the work in a certain way? How do you do that with different projects?
Oh, yeah. It has refined over the years, because in the beginning we used to sit in a room and decide to do the whole thing together and fight every time. Fight. And that's because we're married, right? Like, We each have we have the same dynamic at home, and not that we fight at home, because we actually don't, but we have this, like, because we do the same thing, and because our schedules are crazy and erratic, and you know, most of the time we get a song on Monday and it's due on Friday, or a song on Friday and it's due the next Friday, or if it's a jingle, the song on Monday and we need to buy Wednesday night or Tuesday night even. So JP and I decide who the song is best, decide who's going to take the song first. And we, at home, we do the same thing. Like, okay, I'm going to be doing this. So, you know, you do the dishes, you take the kids to school. And it's not exact, there's really no, schedule at home so much. Like, you know, he brings the kids to school and I pick them up, and we kind of have it, but like dinner, like who knows who's going to make dinner? Who knows? And we do the same thing in songwriting. So JP and I will look at the song on, let's say that there's we get it on Friday night and it's due the next Friday. So Friday we'll say, okay, you know, you start the song. And a lot of times, for example, with Baby Shark, I'll start the song because that's just how it's happened. That's how it's become over the three seasons. So I'll like take it on Friday, dream about it. Somehow there's always a dream. The song always starts with a dream. And in the middle of the night, wake up, write it down. And then it's fun. It's like a puzzle. You don't know what's going to start at first. So sometimes like there's a lyric, or sometimes there's a chorus, a full chorus, like depending on whatever you dream about or whatever, you know, is there. Then I'll start it. I'll do as much as I can, as much as makes sense. Sometimes it's the whole song. Sometimes it's, you know, hey Jay, can you come here and check this out? Like, what is this? And then if I don't do the whole song, he'll take it and he'll say, oh, well, this needs to be truncated. Oh, this needs to be expanded upon. And the same thing goes for the other songs. But the times that we are together, it does work more now than it would in the past, because we'll say, okay, well, this works, but it has to, like I said, it has to be truncated, it has to be expanded upon, it has to be more complex, it has to be simpler. And we have a few projects that, like, mostly me, mostly him, but we always kind of touch everything, I would say.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need my listeners' help. Please consider buying me a coffee. The link to my Ko-fi page is in the description. Every dollar helps me cover the costs of this huge project. Thanks so much.
Do you harmonize after you write melody for the most part?
Vocally?
Well, just in terms of the composition. Like, do
the two of us harmonize?
No, no. I mean, do you write the harmonies under the melody?
Oh, the harmonies. Yeah. Oh, no. If it's a duet and there are harmonies, like we're working on a song for Baby Shark right now where it's Hank and his dad taking a solo in the middle of a big group number. That song, I think when it's a duet, and I think duets are really interesting for me right now because I've been doing like deep dives into different duets because like a lot of times duets have key changes because the two characters are not meshing. They don't have the exact same range, so they can't all be in the same range, but this particular song doesn't. So I like them because they don't have the same range. Hank is kind of up here and his dad is more of like a tenor. So it's so fun to like make their harmonies both melodies as opposed to, you know, under third under or an octave under or something. It's so nice for them to feel like they're both important. But generally like if the song's due Friday, Thursday is when all like my background vocals go into it. And if the characters are singing back up as well, their harmonies will go into it. And I have like their ranges down, but their ranges, if you can really like imagine that you're singing as them, you know their ranges and you will make it so that you're, you know, where the placement of the vocal will be their range. Usually.
Yeah, Kat, it's interesting because you answered a different question than I meant to ask, but it was so much more interesting.
So sorry.
No, much more interesting than what I was going to ask, which was just about chord progressions. But actually that was leading. What you're talking about leads me. I was curious because when you're writing for, let's say, puppets or animated characters, often it's one person does several characters, right? So the way they sing those different characters will be different. And you also act as a vocal coach, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I learned early on as a vocal coach is that the actor's range is different than the character's range. And whether that, it's not because of necessity, although that also plays into it. The necessity is that it won't sound like the character, but also like if the character is here, for example, Kimiko Glenn plays Baby Shark. My mind is on Baby Shark right now. Kimiko Glenn plays Baby Shark and he's a boy. And so when she goes up here beyond Baby's range, it starts to sound not like baby anymore. It starts to sound not just feminine, which is, you know, who cares, but it becomes a different personality. And that's what a great voice actor will do. A voice actor will have many characters because, you know, they'll take 10 parts of their voice and say, this is this character, this is this character. And then underneath, it starts to like not only not sound like baby, but also just has like, it lacks baby's energy. And so it's very important to write within their range. And they have a meaty range, right? And they have like little, like if they do backgrounds, they could do a little bit more. But you really should stay in the middle of a character's range. And then it like makes the song sound 10 times better.
Yeah. Now you grew up singing harmony with your family.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was, my dad and I and my brother used to sing, Doobie Brothers songs and Beach Boys songs as well in the car. Like, cause he really liked those two bands, and I do too. We would sing In My Room. There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to. And like, it was cool, and we didn't do it, you know, it wasn't a lesson or anything. We just, my dad liked to sing harmonies and stuff. And I guess like it became a little bit of an obsession. I really loved harmonies and writing crazy harmonies. So I'd like, we grew up in a Catholic school and they had a choir. So I would like write for the choir, and the choir would be like, we don't do that. The choir director would be like, Catholic music is as is, and we don't. And it's not like, it's just a thing that like Catholic music is, and it stays generally the same. It's not like people, I don't know. Like I know a lot of other religions can do like versions of things, but I noticed that at least in my church growing up, they were like, you know, has to stay. Okay, cool. But I wrote this version of like, you know, We Three Kings or something. And it would just be this like lots of harmonies kind of thing. And we also did madrigals in high school, which is full of harmony. And like, it's so fun to, this isn't nerdy, but I think it's so much fun to like lock into what your harmony is. And especially within madrigals, like madrigals are like, you know, here, I'm going to do this while you do this. And it's so hard to stay there. But it helped, you know, but I did backup vocals for a lot of artists, and I love that. I don't know why, but it's so much fun to like sync with people.
Yeah. So if I understand the progression of your life, so you went back, like you met JP at SUNY Purchase, but before you did that degree, you had this career as a backup singer with big names and big TV shows. Can you describe how that went in your motivation?
Yeah. When I was younger, let me think about this. I met JP in college, and in high school, I fell into this Team 11 thing where we were on the WB network in New York, and like the afternoon you would be listening to Animaniacs or watching what else was on? Animaniacs, and there are like two or three other shows that were so that like I watched every day. So when there was something in my high school, they're like, just audition for this. I happened to get it. I was not a professional kid, but so I had that, and then started, I was started by doing demos for songwriters. There was a local studio that had Carl Sturken and Nevin Rogers. They wrote God Must Have Spent a Little More Time on You, and they've discovered Rihanna. Like they're very, very fun, like boy, they wrote for a bunch of boy bands and Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears. And so I would do demos for them. And then someone from the record label that they were working on, they were like, I want her on all our demos. So she sent my name out to everybody at, I think it was Sony Epic at the time. And so I started singing for all these people and got to like learn how songs came out and learn who was doing what at the time. It was so cool doing that. So when I got to college as a songwriter, I hadn't done much songwriting outside of my own I hadn't done any professional songwriting. That's what I meant to say. I've written my own stuff. But, and so when I met JP, he was a writer and I would just sing his demos. And then we started working together and it was very hard to collaborate. I don't know why, but like everyone at SUNY Purchase was also, songwriters. And there was a lot of like folk music and indie music that was coming out that out of that. Regina Spektor came out of there and, there's a few other very, very talented songwriters that were there. And so when I got the call to write for Sesame Street, I was like, JP, you need to come in, because him and I, like, even though we fought every time we were together, every time we would write, it was just because like both of us were really, really confident about these ideas. And so Jamie'd be like, no, that's, you know, that's not right. We need to do better. Or I'd be like, this needs to be more X, Y, Z. And so, but it always worked the best. Like my songs were good. His songs were good, but our songs together were something else. Really, really, I think good songs. And so, we started writing for Sesame Street in 2008. And from that point on, everything we did was together. Like, I loved jingles and doing nerdy things. So I like hunted down this, I begged her, this very talented jingle singer, Emily Bendiger, to bring me into the world of jingles. So we started writing jingles and, I sang a bunch of them as well. And it just everything started from there. And then once JP came into the fold, JP, like, he's a really good people person, like he's a really good business person, and he knew to like keep at these people and like, you know, hey, we're still available, hey, we're still around, and because of that, the two of us, you know, worked really well, and we started getting stuff by finding it, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, being handed things sometimes, just because like we were the songwriters that were in town at the time, or we were the songwriters that were, you know, around at the time.
Yeah. That brings up a whole bunch of things, but just in terms of understanding your career. So, I mean, you were very busy, like you were singing for The Tonight Show, you're singing for Alicia Keys, and like that must have taken so much time. So that was before you started Earworm Company.
Yes and no. The Tonight Show specifically was after. Okay. Actually, I was 7 months pregnant when I did my first Tonight Show performance. But I mean, a backup performance. Sorry. A lot of these things just, I don't know how to explain how they happen. I guess it's just like talking to people, you know, and maybe it's just like, you know, how women are always like, I don't know, it just happened. But like you actually did work for things. I don't know if it was that. I don't know. But I was doing, I was recording one of my songs before I met JP, but in this, I was in the same school. And I went to a professional studio to record a song that I had written. And I was, I wanted that like a big studio sound, I think. So I went to a studio, and at that studio in Connecticut, there was a musical director, and he was recording a jingle. So I was singing, and he, like in the break room, he said, I just came off of working with Whitney and Michael Jackson. And I'm like, no. Anyway, I kept eating my lunch, and you know, he kept talking, and I'm like, you know, like these people in a studio in Connecticut, you don't think that they're there, you know, like I don't know. So when he said, hey, I need a singer for this jingle, will you do it? I'm like, yeah, of course, no problem. So I go in and I record the jingle for him, and then he said, you know, I work for David Guest, who is a big concert, he has a big concert company, and would you consider singing in it? And I was like of course. So I was, you know, this 19-year-old 5'2" white girl, and I was with the biggest singers in New York at the time who were singing backup. And I got there, I'm like, oh my god, it's Patty Jenkins, oh my god, it's Michael McElroy, oh my god, all these like gigantic backup singers. And it was like the coolest, it was the coolest just to walk into a room with these mega, mega talented people who you knew from Broadway and from just knowing who they were, like hearing talk about them. And so I was doing that when I met JP.
So the harmonies in those kind of situations, is it all written out or are people?
No. Oh, okay. No. You know, I was talking with a friend the other day about this. You know, when I was doing it, it was 2003, I think. When I was working on that stuff, I assumed that everybody was going to get lead sheets, you know, and sometimes we did, of course. Like there was a time when my Mariah Carey was going to be at Madison Square Garden to do, to possibly sing. And here's the sheet music. You got to do your part. You're this, you're second soprano, you're this. But there were also times when about half the time we just kind of picked our harmonies because these singers are top of their craft. They're musical. They have an ear. And so they would say, since these songs are already well known and well recorded, here, listen to this and you take the second harmony. You know, you take the second soprano, you take this. And so by the time we got to rehearsal, we all knew what we were doing. And it really only took a couple of passes to like work out any kinks, you know, in case somebody like went on top of each other's note. What a wild experience it is to be like 19 and just be like, what? Like, this is what you expect me to do. And also because of like just being a nerd, like thinking that you weren't going to be able to do it, but then you just do it. It's like the best trial by fire thing because of course, like the new person that comes in, they were like, who is this person and why are they here? You know, like they don't know nobody. Like why? The coolest, it's the most fun. It's the most fun you can have, I think. No, the most fun I can have. And so there was also one time when we had done at least two rehearsals for each song it wasn't the Grammys. It was another KTU Miracle on 34th Street concert at Madison Square Garden. And we had a 40-piece orchestra and they were singing like songs that you would hear on the radio, but you're actually just playing them live, which is fun. And at the time, there's a lot of artists a lot of their songs were in the box, right? Like meaning there were not a lot of live players on it. So it was cool to, you know, make those songs something. But anyway, in this particular show, Gloria Gaynor, just like the day of the show, came in and she's like, instead of doing I Will Survive, I'm going to do I Am What I Am. I think that's the song. Or a woman. It was something that she just decided to change. So the singer was like, cool, no problem. And they just shoot, you know, and learn their parts, all of our parts. There were five or six of us. And like everyone just knew what to do. It was the coolest. It was so fun doing that stuff because I don't know. I think there's nothing like immediate, you have to do this right now or it'll sound like crap, go.
I'm trying to wrap my head around, like, of course you had a highly developed ear, but when you're listening at that time, when you're first starting to do it, Kat, could you really pick out the second soprano very easily?
Yeah, I think at the time, like right now, songs, there are so many layers, and because everybody's in studio, like 2003 was a funny time, and I don't know if it's still like this. I think we'd all be able to do it anyway, but back in 2001 to 2003, or 2004, I think, that was like the major time of that band. It was people singing as if they were singing live, but singing a track. So for example, it was as if you were in a band and you would sing one part, you know, and you would know where it goes. I think now, like even when I write my background vocals, sometimes I write parts that are like jumping in or sometimes parts there that are stay the same and then they move. So I think that these people could do it now too, but back then you can kind of hear each singer individually. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something, I don't know if everyone, I know a lot of people, I have ADHD and I know a lot of people with ADHD hear the reason that things are confusing for them sometimes, at least a big group of us, is that we hear all things that are going on. So you're hearing the buzz of the like cash register or the buzz of the fan, and you're hearing, when we're at home, I hear both my kids talking and what they're both saying. And I hear, you know, what I'm saying, and I kind of hear what the person who's talking to me is saying. But if you hear it and you could pick each one of those things out at the same time as a musician, you can kind of pick all the harmonies out, or all the bass lines, or all the, you know, drum patterns.
That's really interesting about ADHD, because I think often people just think of it as a disability and they don't realize the special talents you might have.
I hate to be labeled as a person, like the ADHD is a superpower thing, but I think sometimes it can be, and it depends on the person and depends on how they were raised. But I think for me personally, it's the problem and the answer. The problem is that, like, if you hear all these things at once, you just, like, it's overwhelming, and that's where everything falls apart. And also, like, because everything is catching your ear, the next thing is interesting more than what's right in front of you. So, like, if I'm, you know, it's also how I think my career works, because I don't work in a full album or a full this or that. I work in a series and I work in multiple series. So, like, you'll start off writing a quirky Baby Shark song, and then you'll move to a highly educational and also musically super, super, like, what's on the radio right now, or not, just depending on what the song is for Sesame Street. And then we'll move to, like, Tab Time, and Tabitha Brown, who is has a really amazing show that is almost similar to, like, I would say Mr. Rogers. She's got a magical personality, and her show is a comprehensive lesson each show. Hers is, like, calm music, complex music, and, like, just super emotional music. So, and then jingles. Like, jingles are wacky and crazy, and everything has to be thrown at you right away, and each part of the 30 seconds that you get has to catch your ear. And I think that's what allows me personally to be able to move from one thing to another, because if something isn't working, you move on to the next one, and then you move back.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about writing jingles. I know you do a lot of that. And I was curious, does JP reflect back to you, like, hey, we already wrote that? You know what I mean?
Oh, God. All the time. No, not, he doesn't. I do. Sometimes I realize, like, oh, my God, I thought that was so catchy. Sometimes, like, a melody will be catchy, and I'll think that we wrote it before. Because I think good melodies sometimes feel like you already knew it. But sometimes I'm like, I definitely ripped myself off, but I don't know where. Like, what did we rip off? Did we rip off ourselves? Or, like, you know, JP will send me something and be like, oh, well, that happens to be, you know, this melody for something else. But we do check each other. And that's, I think, something that's really important. I used to work for a musicologist named Sandy Wilbur, who was actually the person who did the Blurred Lines case with Robin Thicke. There was a gigantic copyright infringement case between Robin Thicke and the Marvin Gaye estate, where their song "Gotta Give It Up" was. It was such a wild thing, because copyrighted music, you think of it as music and lyrics, and music and lyrics are the proof when you're in a copyright case that you intended to sound like this other song. But this case, in "Got to Give It Up," the music, the lyrics and the melody were not the same, but clearly they were trying to rip it off. And actually, there was an article in maybe Variety magazine where they had to prove, he said, we wanted to sound like "Got to Give It Up" by Marvin Gaye, and that's why he lost the case. But, like, you know, anyway, having worked with Sandy Wilbur, we always know when we are accidentally, you know, infringing. And so writing kids' music, it's important to sound like something you would hear on the radio, but it can't actually be that. Although I think you do get a little bit more leeway because, you know, it's kids' music. Like, they're okay. Like, if, for example, a song parody that you're writing to sort of sound like a song on purpose mm-hmm. so that the parents would understand. You know, the parents would be like, oh, yeah, that's supposed to be XYZ.
So you were mentioning Sandy Wilbur, the musicologist. What work did you do for her?
I was I don't even know how I heard about it. I think it was through somebody at college. At the time, it was the transition to all digital music. So she had this whole CDs upon CDs. Her job was to know all the music there is out there, to know if it was like jingle houses would send her their songs, and pretty much all of them. We got so many. And it's also one of the reasons I became obsessed with jingles, because I was listening to them all the time, but also knowing the names of all those companies, I'd be like, hey, I want to work for you. So she would get these jingles, and the companies knew that they wanted to sound like this song. And they would say, okay, the reference is this too close? And so we would go in and, of course she would know, intrinsically she would know it was or was not, but she had to, show it. And she would say, well, this part is too close. And sometimes she would show me here's the two melodies, and their shapes of them on the sheet music, or the lead sheet would go, they're both going down here and then they're both continuing. There was one time we were putting something against Barry White's Love Unlimited, I think it was called, the Love Unlimited Orchestra. There was a string section that went, I think you know that song, I just don't remember, the title of it. And we were listening to a pop song that was out there to see if they sampled it. Mm. And she showed it to me visually. You can pull out the waveform and you can see that there are not an actual imprinted watermark on purpose, although people have been doing that since. But you could see that the waveform not only looked like it, but when you pulled it apart, even the actual waveform was exactly the same. And it could be sped up, right? We had to slow it down. We had to pitch it. But once you got there, those patterns were all the same. And that's how you proved that it was an actual sample. So cool.
Wow.
It was so interesting to work for a musicologist. And it was so helpful being in music to know musicology.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I was just thinking, your parents, you and JP, and in terms of looking back on, you grew up, in the 90s?
Mm-hmm.
So things have changed in terms of the audience for what you might call all ages shows, or people call kids shows, because a lot of adults love Baby Shark and lots of other shows, Sesame Street. And it used to be that families would watch things together, and now we're the headphone culture. So parents mm-hmm. don't necessarily hear what their kids are listening to or watching, even young children.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I should say, I think half the parents mm-hmm. are watching with the kids in any specific age. Because, for example, my two kids who are 6 going on 7 and 5, they just turned 5, we're watching with them because we know that there's so much stuff on YouTube that you'll accidentally come across something that is... Ella came across something where they were burying her mother, mm-hmm. And it was a kid's show, but I think it was from another country that frankly, they just showed more, they were just, they talked about more than we do generally. And so if I had known that, I would have been able to talk to her about it. But that was the last day that we did that. Mm-hmm. But I think as you get older, kids are definitely watching more on their tablets and, by themselves, because everybody gets a screen, right? So you don't need that family TV. But there, that's interesting, because there's also the explosion of the kids series, right? Which means that there's a series I'm thinking of all things that are coming up that I can't talk about, but mm-hmm. there are... so many series where you have something specific and you can watch it, whereas your brother or sister may not want to watch it. They're not interested in that very specific thing. But after all that, right now, right like at this moment, networks and streaming networks are paring back. So it's actually for some, I think it's mostly because, you know, all, if you spread this much viewership into this many shows, each is only getting a small viewership, obviously. And I don't think they were making the money that they thought they would be making. So they're actually consolidating it again. And so now we are about to go into a place where it's a family show. So it's like for all ages, all children and parents. So I don't know, like, what is going to happen now, but in terms of how we write for at the moment for like specific kids shows, that's what's so fun about it, because not everybody watches quirky shows, and not everybody watches very emotional shows, and like that's what's so fun about being a writer right now. I imagine that if you were writing, if all the songs were to sound the same, it would not be nearly as fun. Mm-hmm. And if all the shows were not, you know, were written by the same person, it would not be as fun. So I really enjoy being in the same style, rather. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy writing for different styles.
So there's someone in my family who's a huge Pokemon fan. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. So you sang on the Pokemon Rival Destinies theme song.
I did. I sang on a couple of them. Okay. I sang that and black and white. Yeah. And actually my friends Jason and Katie sang on the original Pokemon theme song. Okay. Super talented, both of them. And they're like also gigantic session singers from New York. Yeah, it's so cool. I didn't realize like there are people that contact me via Instagram or via email. And they're like, hey, I love this. Like, and I'm like, oh my God, like, how did you know about it? But so there's such a big viewership mm-hmm. of Pokemon, and I love it too. Like I listen to it a lot. We sometimes do little parodies of that for other shows. Okay. Which is so fun. I love that, like, dramatic music.
Mm-hmm. So even though you guys have a well-established company, you still have to pitch, right?
Totally. I think we know a bunch of the songwriters that are out there, and we all have to pitch. And I don't know if it's like that for everyone, for every, I don't know if it's like that for every part of the music business. I hope not. But I know that because we're writing shorter songs that they're like, well, show us what you got. You know, I guess it's, it's part of the job. I guess they think they're getting the best product, but I find that like, there's a difference in writing what you know you have and what you think you might lose. And one is that you're writing something that you know that if it doesn't go final, because no one has the 100% success rate in a pitch, especially when they're blind, because they don't, you know, you don't know who is competing against you. And you always compete against your friends, by the way, which is cool because, you know, you always go back at the end, like, what did you write? When you write a pitch, you're writing a pitch so that it sounds like something, one, that you can use again, right? If it doesn't get placed. So you're having, so even though it's specific, you can change the lyrics, right? Of course. Two, you're writing something that like is specifically catchy, that you feel like it is going to be different from the other pitches that are out there. Whereas when you write on a song that you have been given, you have to put more effort into it because it's something that is an actual product. Like there's not going to be a bunch of rounds or anything like that where you have to you give it what it actually needs for the show. And I think that the one where you're given it, if you care about it, is the one that's going to be the better product. But everybody pitches, no matter what.
So does JP play different instruments on these tracks, like in terms of your production?
Yeah. I play keys. I play some accordion, some melodica, some I'm teaching myself guitar, and I produce in the box, of course. And I do that mostly for Baby Shark. And then JP plays a bunch of brass instruments, and he plays specifically the trombone, and he has a bajillion guitars on his side. And of the we have two different studios because, again, we write separately on purpose. He plays the harmonicas. He just picks up instruments, which I think is so cool. You know, anytime he sees something that, you know, is in a there's a website called Pay It Forward, where you, if you're done with something, you know, you put it out there, and then if somebody wants it or to buy it or to take it, they'll do that. So he's always like bringing home fun instruments, and so now we have a big collection of them.
Cool,
just so fun.
So excuse my ignorance, but you said I produce in the box. You mean, explain what you meant by that.
Well, especially with the very quick turnaround things, I have like in my sessions, when I open up Pro Tools, I have, and we always work in Pro Tools, not because it's better, but because it's when there are short deadlines, you have to go into Pro Tools anyway for broadcast. So we work in Pro Tools to begin with. I have a thing where I have like MIDI instruments and then live instruments, and I have a set of MIDI instruments and a set of live instruments. And so, you know, of course, a lot of things recently are synth based, so you have all that which will stay, and some of the acoustic instruments will get replaced once they're finalized. Mm-hmm. But with quick turnarounds, it's always it's always easier for sure to keep it in the box. So usually we have like live guitars, and we have, sometimes we'll hire players, but most of the time when it's a very quick turnaround, we have to keep some of it in the box. So in the box, meaning in
samples.
The computer box. Yeah, okay. Not samples, but like MIDI instruments. Okay. Oh, sampled instruments. Yes.
So, yeah, I understand. So,
and synths and things like that.
So all those things, but in the, yeah, got it now.
Okay. Yeah. We have some cool bass sounds, which we replace half the time. But sometimes like you want that sound. You want that in the box sound for, depending if the project calls for it, of course.
And you're always recording many different voices. Do you manipulate your own voice in when you're producing to get it to go lower or different kind of qualities?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's, we use, a plugin called, Mofoder. I think it's called Mofoder. Where it is like we have a few things. We have a talk box where you sing into it and it has like the tube that comes out, and you can make that like who does it a lot? Daft Punk, like that sound. That robotic, okay, vocoded sound. Yeah. But we also have this thing called Mofoder. I think it's called Mofoder. I have to check it out. Where you'll sing something and you play MIDI notes, and it will play the MIDI notes in your voice. So it's meant to sound different. Like a lot of people, when there's not a lot of time, will sing one harmony and then move it to sound like them. I don't particularly do that, but I do it for effect, and it's so cool. It sounds like you can really mess with it and really get it to sound however you want it. You can get it to sound like a pad that has words, you know, that has like, you could make it sound like words, but also sound like a pad, or you can make it sound, you know, any way you want. You can make it sound like brass. You can make it sound like a crazy synth, and that is so much fun, especially in backup vocals.
Okay. Yeah, just to wrap up about the pitch, I'm just curious. So for young people starting out, like if they don't have this whole production thing that you do, like it's expensive because you're not paid to pitch, right? You have to just...
No, you're not paid to pitch, no. But I think it is important. And I think it's why it's a young person's game to start out when you're young. But, you know, depending on what... It has to be a hobby, right? If it's not, because you have to really put a lot of time into it. And you have to put a lot of time. But the one good thing... It's money, but it's not as much money as it used to be. I tell people who are just starting out, who are songwriters, that you should have a recording setup, because you can't just walk around like playing things for people, and you can't pitch it that way, and they won't. Like a lot of times, people will not accept a piano vocal, because essentially it's part of the gig. You have to be a producer. You have to know a singer that you can hire all the time and pay them, but not get paid for it, you know? And you have to you have to produce, you have to mix, you have to compose, you have to harmonize, you have to sing, you know, you have to do all the things yourself. So I would say it's really important to have a recording set up. And I've found some really great products that are cheap, that are, you know, you don't have to go to a studio every time. Like, I had a friend that would always go to the studio to produce and record and write, and that would be so expensive. So fortunately, I found Condenser Mic by Blue. I don't know if they make this particular one anymore, but there was a Blue Spark digital mic that was $150, and it sounded nearly as good as this. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a fantastic condenser mic that's USB powered, and you can record on a tablet, but obviously you need the USB connection. I don't know, I haven't done it in a while, but it was my travel setup for a while. And then you can also get like a $50 keyboard, and you can get a $200 computer, and you can work. You can't work in GarageBand, but there a lot of the programs are like pay by month. They're subscription based. So if you can like get yourself that kind of a setup and just play, just practice, and like try to emulate what you hear. Like, one of the things that we really enjoyed and that kept us up to date was when we were working for Kids Bop. I used to sing for Kids Bop, and we also like do Kids Bop tracks every once in a while. And it's so fun because you literally have to go in and say, what is the producer doing on the drums? What are they doing on the synths? How are they played? Are they manipulated in any way? And you, in finding those things, in emulating a song that already exists, you can teach yourself production. And that's one thing that like doesn't inherently come, because you can't just, you know, you can produce in a studio and know what you want, but to actually be able to do it in the box, you have to just practice and practice and practice. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a good way to start.
Yeah. I was curious, in terms of boundaries with your home life and these tight deadlines, how do you guys manage to keep it all together?
It's harder to do in the summer, I can tell you that. Yeah. that when they're in camp and when they're in school, it's helpful. It's helpful to have deadlines. For me, it's very helpful to have deadlines. And those deadlines include being done, you know, one of us being done by 3:30 when they get out of school. They go to an after school program sometimes when the work is a lot, especially when we were working last year, we were working on 6 shows at once. And so that was a lot. And it was constantly like a rush, 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 rush. But those quick deadlines are very helpful, because nothing is precious. Like, sometimes your best, especially when it comes to pop music, sometimes your first idea is your best, and you don't know it until you had to accept it, you know, like you, but I think at this point we have a schedule. Like, Monday we think about the song and we start with the first item that we love. Tuesday, the second thing, whether it's lyrics, like hashing out the lyrics. Wednesday, we do the production. Thursday, we do the background vocals. And Friday, we mix and send. It's helpful to know that you have a deadline. So the kids, I try to make it so that at that time when they come home, for them and mostly for me, I separate church and state. I go upstairs and I'm done, and I can actually walk up the steps. Like, it's helpful to have separation. And that goes for like talking about music. JP and I will be like, okay, we're not talking about this. It's great. It's terrible, whatever it is, but we'll talk about it tomorrow at 9 o'clock after the kids are in school. And that's, I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's, we love it. And we're both like, want to talk about it all the time because we love music and we love, you know, I love like saying quirky things that are really funny, or puns, or whatever, or like, oh, that chord change is so cool, like the key change is so cool. But we talk about it tomorrow at 9 o'clock.
And how are you managing music education for your kids? I mean, they're still young, but have you talked about it?
Yeah, we talk about it a lot, because my daughter was really, really talented. My son is younger and he walks around singing things all the time. And he literally, like, there is no end to him singing. And my mom used to say the same thing about me, that like, I would sing all the time, nonstop. And she'd be like, she never like made fun of me. She never told me to stop or made, you know, like got annoyed by it. But she told me how much it was like crazy as an adult. And I'm like, oh, I thought you liked that. Like, or not that, I'm sorry, more like, I didn't know you heard that. Like, I don't know you care. Like, I didn't know that it, I don't know. I wasn't very self aware back then, but I know that they're doing that now. And so like, the problem is with kids, when I say, Ella, do you want to, you know, do you want a voice lesson or something? She'll be like, yeah, yeah, cool. But then she'll get there and she'll be like, no, I'm good. I'm going to go play this or that. And so we're trying to figure out ways to do it. One thing that helps a lot, like, is if she'll sing around the house and then I'll be like, sounds really good. I'll notice that she'll continue doing it. But there was one time where she was teaching herself to play the Inside Out theme. Do you know the Pixar movie Inside Out with the characters Joy, Sadness? They're all like personified. Yeah. So she was playing the theme, Riley's theme. And I was like, okay, I can't mess this up. I got to do something. I want to help her, but I'm not going to directly help her because she doesn't like that. And so I took my iPad with the song on it, because I noticed she started to, like, was starting to slow down a little bit. And I put it there. I was like, here, if you want it. And I walked away. She stopped. She's like, I'm not doing this. She knows I'm doing it. I'm not doing it. I think, like, as latchkey kids when we were little, we were allowed to just be by ourselves and nobody kind of bothered us. And kids don't get that so much these days. So I'm trying to, like, stay away. And let them really enjoy it themselves. But they're doing it. They're doing it on their own. She's like teaching, like she taught herself things on piano that I didn't know at that time. And she's teaching, and Benny's like, I don't know. He's really good at like making up things that rhyme. And it's all things that like we did as kids, as musical kids, that are happening. But I just can't, for some reason I'm not allowed, which I understand. I guess I wouldn't want my mom doing that either.
Yeah.
You have to like be sneaky about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like both my husband and I are violinists. And of course we wanted our kids, you know, to play, and I even bought all this like four violin music. I thought it would be a thing.
Here, I'll put this here. And what happened?
Well, our older daughter did play violin for a while and a whole bunch of other instruments, but she said at a certain point, it's pretty hard with you guys being at a certain level, and I'm just, you know, it's not for me. And she loves music, but she went in a totally different direction creatively. She has a creative career, but not in music. Yeah. And yeah. Our younger daughter, I think we're smart enough to let things go, you know.
Did they pick those books up at any point?
No, I mean, you can tell when kids are doing things to please you and when it's coming from them, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Like,
I'm gonna... But how could... Isn't it difficult as a young kid? I mean, I guess it's vocally the same thing where you have to pitch it yourself, but like, did you put any dots on the violin? Did you do anything to like show them where the pitches were? Did you put one out like and they picked it up or not picked it up, or... They were just not interested.
Oh, I taught them both violin to a certain level. I don't want to get into the pedagogy. I think we need to use our ears and sense of touch. And the trouble is when, yeah, that's like a whole thing, but yeah, whether we use tape or not. But I won't get into teaching music, but it's, it's interesting. I think a lot of classical musicians like myself, they will listen to a lot of classical music in their home. But my husband and I are not of that ilk because it's just so much. We work in an orchestra. So the kids didn't grow up listening to symphonies. Oh, you know, people make that assumption. Right. But no, that's not what was playing on our stereo.
Did you take them to performances? Were they interested in it?
They did to a certain extent. But yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah.
Very tough. Yeah. It's so tough to have, like, obviously, you know, and I know, having grown up around music. Like, my dad played in wedding bands, but he loved he loved music. So it was always there. And it was just like seeping by osmosis. Like, oh, I loved it. And I was listening, you know, you listen to like Linda Ronstadt, and there's so many like songs, like all Stevie Wonder, like every Stevie Wonder song there ever was, and the Doobie Brothers, and, you know, those kinds of things. Or like, remember, I mean, I'm sorry, when I was younger, listening to Carole King, I'm like, oh, that stinks. Why does he listen to that? And I'm like, ah, her voice, like, what? But then you listen to it as an adult and you're like, oh, wow. Like, that's really good. And I don't know, like, you're just around it all the time. So you do absorb it. But so to teach them, they'll learn to learn anyway, I guess. I hope. I don't know. She's in a choir. Ella's in a choir. Benny, I put it in an acting class because he's always, like, every day he dresses up as something else. So I'm like, maybe he'll like acting. But at the time, he didn't take to it. So I don't know. I'm really interested to see if they're interested or if they're, like, totally turned off because they're hearing it all the time.
Yeah. So did you have any kind of classical training growing up?
Yeah, I voice lessons. I mean, I did pick up the violin, and I tried to teach myself violin just because I'm like, oh, this is fun. Like, I don't know. We didn't have like a lot of money growing up. So I wasn't able to be in like anything I wanted. So my mom would like always, you know, be the class mom and be able to get the things for free. I think that's how it worked out. I couldn't get violin lessons. I never asked for them either. But like when I was a little bit older, I rented a violin for 2 weeks or 3 weeks to see if I could get it. And it was like, it was such like a world that like, there are some times where you have to say, okay, enough. Like you can't do deep dives on every hobby that you have. I mean, you can, but you're going to burn out. And like, so anyway, but I did have I was part of a choir, and over the summer, the choir had like a camp, and each summer we would get private voice lessons. And I was, I got lessons from this amazing soprano. Her name is Nell Snidus. And she had the most amazing, like, up here. I got a few different types of voice lessons that were really interesting. The first voice lessons that I got when I was little, but she taught me how to sing like from your diaphragm. But like, she didn't call it that because we were in fifth grade. She just said, you know, sing from your belly and like get the sound out and like pull into the emotion and know it and like sing that way. But then a couple of years after that, in this choir, this liturgical choir, we're not very religious. I just happens to come up a couple times today. Sorry. But we were taught to sing up here. So my choir teacher would say, have us go, my name is Julia Child. And, you know, to sing from your cheeks from up here. And it felt like such two total different worlds. But she had me sing up there, and we would do like La Chaque Pianga and like all these like amazing arias. It like, there was a while where like we got into John Rutter. My high school, we got into John Rutter for classical stuff. And to hear, as a kid, you're always, at least as a kid, I would be like, that's so stuffy, or like, that's so this or that. And then when you really listen to it, you say, oh my God, like, you could see like in the evolution of classical music, how it was influenced by jazz and how like the harmonies were changing. And now like it's some of my favorite stuff because it's so, just to have so many people playing the same piece of music at once is amazing. Mm-hmm. There's so much room for harmony and there's so much use of it. And the timbres, like being able to change, to have the ability to, for the different timbres to each show in one piece of music is so cool. Mm-hmm.
So in your role as a coach, often you're working with celebrities. What kind of advice are you, or what kind of skills are you working on with them?
There are two different types of vocal coaches. There's vocal coach and there's a voice director. I have been a vocal coach. There was a couple times where I vocal coached Joss Stone in studio, but it wasn't exactly voice lessons. It was more like vocal production. So now as a vocal producer, which is very different, I'm just working with people who know what they're doing already. So it's more like making sure, for example, making sure that the character still sounds like the character, helping them find a way to make the character in that note, or helping them make sure that, especially in animated music, in animated series rather, when the character is doing a sound that their live face is not showing on, that sentiment still has to be accurately reflected in their tone or in their performance or their the way they sing it. So sometimes like they'll be smiling on the Zoom because New York and LA do it over Zoom a lot of times. They'll be smiling, but it won't come out. And so you'll have to say like, oh, put a little bit more smile, put an exaggerated smile on that. But a lot of times these people are so good that they are just able to do it. So half my job is just writing down best takes,
okay,
you know, and then putting them together. And fortunately for our music, it's nice to be able to be the person that does the takes, the select takes, which is like the best, you know, the best one. So if you do it five times, you'd be like, okay, line one, take two, line two, take four. It's nice to be able to do that because you know that you're going to get what you imagined you would get. And they know what's best for their character too. But I got to vocal coach Cardi B when she was doing the Seaweed Sway. And she, again, same thing. Like, there's no one that could be a better Cardi B than Cardi B. Like, there's nothing I could teach her that she wouldn't No, like she's the best version of herself. I'm not. I did her vocal demo, but I'm not. There's nobody that's better than Cardi So she so my job was just to she'll be like, can I do that again or whatever. But also like to say this word didn't come out for the kids like it sounded like it did. So you know, making sure that the words are articulate enough sometimes is your job as a vocal coach for kids music, especially.
Yeah, that makes sense. So with animated series and even puppetry, if there's an illness or someone has a problem with their voice, do they sometimes bring in a sub and then the audience may not know if they're really good at imitating or?
Never. Not once have I heard that. Okay. A lot of times they will, that is interesting. Because they could, right? If somebody was really, really good. I don't remember who it was, but I know this happened with somebody very famous, but I can't remember who it was. Someone went to go replace a demo singer's voice. Oh, I know who it was, and I don't think I can tell this. It's somebody like super, super famous. It's an animated character in an animated series that's very, 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 very well known, and she went to go replaced because she had a cold. She went to go replace that take and she'd be like, what's wrong with it? We don't have to replace it. Because a lot of times you'll go back in for ADR, which is I think automated dialogue. I think that's what it's called. Auto dialogue recording. I don't remember. Replacement.
Yeah.
So when they have to do it again, they'll go in and replace what they did to make it better. And she's like, what's the matter with that one? That one's so good. And the person's like, well, that wasn't you. Which is funny because like as an animated character, like everybody has a version of like, you know, Al Pacino that they think they can do really well, or like Matthew McConaughey, like that they think they can do really well. So plenty of people rehearse, you know, like do it like that. That being said, and this is off topic, so forgive me, but there are characters when you're doing their demos that absolutely do not want you to sound like them. And then there are other characters that really do want you to sound like them. So for example, my first character that I ever wrote for was Elmo. And someone someone had like taken me to the side. He's like, just so you know, Kevin, who was Kevin Clash, was playing Elmo at the time. He does not want you to sound like Elmo, because like, imagine hearing people's, I don't know if he thought they were bad, but like people's impressions of you over and over and over again. Like, it must sound so, for lack of a better term, disrespectful. Like, but it's not. It's meant with love. But, and then there are other characters that are like, you have to sound like them so that they know what to do.
Mm-hmm. So are there well-known characters you can do at the drop of a hat? Like now?
I think I can in my head, but let me see. Who do I have? I have, oh, over the, hold on. I can show you the difference between new Elmo and old Elmo. I'm not, again, I don't sound like them, just so you know, but old Elmo used to have this like thing where he had like a New York accent, but I don't really, again, I'm not very good at it. I just know it in my head. And then new Elmo has like a little bit of like, he's a little more street smart, I think. The way that Ryan plays him, like a little bit more street smart. So new Elmo is a little bit, he sounds exactly the same in tone. Mm-hmm. So like he really has it. And you really have to just be listening to it every day to know that it's not exactly the same. But he really like, I don't think anybody knew when old Elmo and new Elmo switched. But new Elmo is a little bit more like this. And he has a little bit of like, he has like an almost like an edge. It's so funny to listen to him because I love new Elmo's, like he plays things like a little bit wiser. So fun to listen to. No, I don't have any good impressions. But in my head, like when I write for the characters, I know what they're going to sound like, which is the reason I don't try to sound like them a lot of the times.
Well, we started with Friends with a Penguin and We Don't Walk Alone. So one of your roles as a creator is kind of expressing emotions for kids that maybe they didn't know they had. Mm. Maybe you could speak to that.
That's something really important to me. And as an underscore composer as well, especially within kids' music, JP does a lot of the underscoring for series. So I don't do as much of it, but We Don't Walk Alone and Friends with a Pen, there's so many that, especially in Sesame Street specifically. Sesame Street is so brilliant at it. Because their lyrics are never what you think. Like if we wrote the song a different way, you would never know what the song is about. And I think having a melody, it's a little bit complex, so forgive me if it's not really making sense, but I'll just tell you. When you write a melody for a very complex song, like a song, we wrote a song about divorce when Abby's mom and dad, she was talking about them being divorced and having big feelings about it. The song was called Big Feelings. And the We Don't Walk Alone. And Friends with a Penguin was the, I'll talk about that separately. But just talking like musically how this works, your melody has to be a child's melody. So they have to be able to sing it because if they're thinking about it, it's like when a child dreams or plays, how they're playing they're playing simply, but they're playing because they're having such big feelings. Like when my soon to be kindergartner plays school, like he's worried about it. So you'll see that the character, it's like play therapy, right? Like the characters do the things that you're worried about. So the melody has to be a kid's melody, but the things behind it project the feelings that you really want, you know, the feelings, the real things. And so when you have a complex song, it's important to like empathize with the child, what they're actually feeling, those feelings they don't have words for, and they don't even maybe know they're having. Like sometimes in play, like a kid will be jealous, but they don't know what it is. So they'll think it's like that the person is taking something from them or something. We Don't Walk Alone started with, it was supposed to be gun violence. And so lyrically, the child could only talk about how he's feeling alone, but he's not talking about grief per se and not out loud, but in the music feels just like I told you about, like how we made the beginning of the song, like Like, you don't have a center. Like, you don't know where we're not. I'm not grounded anymore. Like, I was, but I'm not. And feeling alone. And they can't talk about it, but they can say, I relate to this sound, this sonic landscape. I connect to that. And I don't know why, but they don't have to know why. They have to let the music, which could be in another language and sometimes, like, you know, it could be made up syllables, but if they know that that's what they're feeling, it's almost like you can musically take them into a place where you feel grounded, and you can tell them why with a simple melody, you know? And so that was that one. And Friends with the Penguin was like another interesting one, because it's obviously about seeing a trans kid or a person who's like displaying a gender that is not there, that is not what you would expect to see a child like that. And that's like it wasn't supposed to be, you know, you don't really we're not trying to connect with the confused feelings, because we're trying to tell the kid, like, hey, all you got to do is say hi. That's it. Just say hi. Like, that's how to do it. So it's more like, that was more like a, this is how to do it, instead of I empathize with you and you know, because that's, grief is, there's no answer for that. There's, you have to sit with it. But for Friends with a Penguin, it was like, I'm gonna celebrate the introduction. That's all it is. Because after that, this kid is not a stranger anymore. This kid is a person. And that's, you know, the answer, most of the time, that's the answer to kids noticing that people are not like them. At around age 4, I think they say that kids start to realize that other kids are not like them. That, you know, that's the answer to 4-year-old noticing. You just say, you have to know that they're people, right? Which, it sounds silly, but you have to just know somebody, and that's it. You just say hi, and then you start playing together. That's kind of all it takes at 4.
Really beautifully said. Well, thanks so much, Kat, for sharing your perspectives today. Really appreciate it.
Of course, Leah. Thank you so much for having me on the show and chatting about all this stuff, because it's, I don't know. I guess people don't, you know all of those things about, like, how the industry works and, you know, things like that. So it's nice to, like, talk about it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. There's such a fascinating variety to life in music, and this series features wonderful musicians worldwide with in-depth conversations and great music, with over 100 episodes to explore. Many episodes feature guests playing music spontaneously as part of the episode or sharing performances and albums. I hope that the inspiration and connection found in a meaningful creative life, the challenges faced, and the stories from such a diversity of artists will draw you into this weekly series with many topics that will resonate with all listeners. Please share your favorite episodes with your friends, and do consider supporting this independent podcast. The link is in the description. Have a great week.